On this episode of the podcast, I have with me Vlad Eidelman. He is the CTO at Fiscal Note. We're going to be talking about leadership growth. Vlad's got a very interesting background, great journey into the CTO role. He's going to kind of walk us through how he's done that, and we're going to learn a lot more about that process. And Vlad, I'm super excited for you to be on the show.
Thank you, Amir. Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. I guess let's start off the top before we get going to understand what Fiscal Note does and just what are some of the functions that you're responsible for as the CTO?
Absolutely. So Fiscal Note's been around for about 10 years now as a company. I joined when we were less than 10 folks and now all the way through to our IPO last year. And so the mission and the vision of the company has stayed pretty consistent across those 10 years, although the actual execution and what we do has changed. So the vision has always been the world is complex. It's constantly changing, particularly with regard to policies, regulations, and what's going on in general markets. And what we want to do and what we have software as a service products to do is capture as much of that information as possible from the local to state to federal to global levels around the world in many countries on what's going on in the world, what kind of policies, regulations are changing, and what do people need to do about them. So our customers are generally in corporations, in government agencies, in nonprofits, and all of them care about changes in current laws and regulations and the ways that they can work to understand the impacts on their companies and how they impact those in return and how the governments are shaping those policies. And we do that by collecting a lot of data from the external world, as well as combining that with a lot of AI and internal data science and in human subject matter expertise and workflows that we build in our products and our software as a service applications. And in my role as CTO, essentially, I lead our global R&D organization, which is composed of multiple different product development teams covering the whole entire stack from the data collection, ingestion, analysis, refinement, the internal analytics stacks, as well as the DevOps and overall application operations. So leading the global vision strategy for that.
Awesome. Thanks for the overview. I think part of the conversation is going to actually be talking about how you did get to the CTO role, and I'm excited to kind of cover that with you. And I guess the reason we picked this of all the topics that we could have picked could have been something AI, because obviously you have a background in that. But I think this is a good story to tell. Is you have a non-traditional background as a CTO. I guess you started out and started up that data science path, and maybe you can kind of fill in the gaps of that part of your background for us.
Absolutely. So for the last over 15 years or so, my background, my PhD, my other industry and academic work has all been in building machine learning systems, especially for language processing. And so I came into Fiscal Note as the first hire on the machine learning side. So there's a front-end engineer, back-end engineer, and myself. And I came very early on to build out our data science capabilities. So starting off as a individual contributor, I started to build out a lot of the initial kind of models that we needed to do to process various things. And then over time, I started to build out the data science team itself. So went from an individual contributor to a manager of that team. And then with time, that grew to encompass analytics team that looked at not just the product use cases externally, but the internal use cases of data science and data analytics. And then over time, that responsibility grew to encompass the entire data operations of ingestion of data all the way through to refinement. And then in the last year or so, that's grown all the way to encompass all of our different application development and various capabilities that are supporting our R&D development. And so it's definitely not what I expected when I joined 10 years ago. I thought I'd really be focusing on the AI part. But I think one of the lessons learned here is that you don't really know what you're going to expect. I think there's a lot of opportunities that are coming and become available. And it's just, it's incumbent upon the person who's in it to realize if they're interested and available to take on that next challenge. Because inevitably, as the startup grows, you're going to have different hats you're going to have to wear. And sometimes the hats are natural to you. And it's an obvious growth, like from an individual contributor, maybe to a manager on a specific kind of team. And sometimes they're less obvious. I've seen a lot of people come in Fiscal Note early on and really move around the organization and become extremely successful in roles that are completely different from what they were hired for because it was a need that was there and they were comfortable enough to be able to go and move that. And so I think that's been luckily part of my career where I was successful enough in the role I was taking on that the people around me felt comfortable giving me an opportunity that I wasn't clearly the right person for, you know, if you're going to have the best possible person that you can look for. But there was enough confidence that I'd be able to level up quickly and learn and be able to accomplish some things.
And I think you mentioned, you know, other people were comfortable with you and believe that you would be able to absorb those additional skills. I guess though, at a personal level, and you kind of mentioned you're being pushed into uncomfortable areas. You have to develop some skills that you previously maybe hadn't worked on or just hadn't, you know, evolved as strongly as others. How did you deal with that? Because obviously going from, you know, somebody who's responsible for all data science, AI, ML into the CTO, there are different hats.
Yes. So this is where I think my academic background probably is a big service. So I think often people ask, should I go get a PhD? And my answer certainly changes based off of what, you know, we're talking about, whether it makes sense. But one of the foundational things is what you get out of a PhD is perseverance. It's the ability to be very comfortable in ambiguity of staring at a blank page or staring at ideas that look very similar to what you thought you're the only one doing it. And in any of those cases, being very comfortable in acknowledging that either you don't know as much as you thought, or that there's other people who know a lot more than you, and there's a lot more going on than you initially thought. There's going to be these roller coaster curves up and down. And just being comfortable that there's a marathon that you're running as opposed to a sprint. The marathon being a constant development and learning and growing, and being able to acknowledge other people's ideas are better or more important than yours. Being very comfortable asking questions when you don't know the answer, especially. I think one of the first lessons I learned in my undergrad, where I majored in philosophy and computer science, and the philosophy part was the important part is not knowing the answer necessarily, it's knowing the right questions to ask. And then when I started off in my graduate course, one of the biggest kind of takeaways and lessons was I was doing a summer research program, and a very well-known professor, extremely well-known in the field, started asking what even I would consider kind of very rudimentary questions about a subject, and felt obviously no shame, no other kinds of embarrassment on it. And it kind of clicked it in my mind that, you know, we're all equal here. It doesn't matter if you know a lot somewhere else, if you have a certain reputation, really we're trying to understand and learn and grow, be curious with positive intent, right? To really move forward together. And so I think that mentality, bringing it back to Fiskenup, has allowed me to be able to build the company's kind of development teams and all the things that we're doing in a way that tries to keep it in a minimal hierarchy. So I assume that everyone's ideas are valid. Everyone is going to bring something, especially if they're closer to the problem, bring something that's much more valid than I possibly could. And so I just try to make it very easy, psychologically safe, available to have people be able to communicate up and down, across. And for myself, to be comfortable that I might be wrong a lot of the time. And so I try to be confident and quick in the decisions that I make, which is often a reasonable, I think, counter to academics, is that they can be slow and analysis by paralysis. So that's something that you definitely have to watch for. And that's something that I've learned as part of what I had to grow into, is being able to be comfortable making quicker decisions where not all the information might be as available as I would like. But at the same time, being very comfortable admitting when I'm wrong and listening to someone else. I'm a huge believer in upward management, where, again, I think that the person who is closer to the problem is closer to the solutions. And I'm here to provide the intent and the mission and how critical certain things are and the priorities, because that's the context that everyone needs, is to believe in the mission, to understand what it is and why they're doing something. And then the actual what and how, I'm certainly very comfortable letting go of. I think one of the other lessons I've learned early on is, again, when you're growing in an individual contributor role, you're likely good at it and you get promoted into a manager role because you might be one of the better people at that role. And usually the people who report to you, you really know well what they're doing, and you can give them direct guidance on, you know, you should build this way, or this is the right set of processes to use, or this is how you evaluate a model. As you grow, and as I've grown to manage managers and then VPs of managers and directors and other senior level executives, I have many people whose roles I have never done, nor will I know how to do those roles. And so I have to be very comfortable in understanding that just because I don't know how to do the role doesn't mean that I still can't provide guidance or understand what the important parts of their jobs are to create the right environment for them to be able to operate.
Absolutely. I'm gonna come back to this train of thought, but I want to ask a question on something you talked about within your PhD program about asking questions. I was always taught if you don't ask, you don't get. So I just realized at an early age, I just have to, if you ask more questions, sometimes it helps you process information and sort through what you're missing to get to the ultimate goal that you're, whatever question you were originally asking for. I guess when you look at asking questions and sometimes you see people who are very open and you see some people who are very hesitant and it's kind of difficult for them. Some people are like, oh, it seems like more art than science. To me, it's like, well, if you ask, you ask. The person has the option of answering or not. When you have staff, and obviously you have tons of people that ask you questions, I mean, that's a difficult, I mean, it's not a difficult thing sometimes for somebody to ask a question of their superior because they worry how they're going to look. And I think that's a big barrier to why people don't ask questions. But what are your views on helping people as a leader ask questions more comfortably so they can actually go, you know what? No judgment. You ask the question. Maybe you should have known it. Maybe you shouldn't have, but it's better you ask than you go spin your wheels for 3 hours.
Absolutely. That's a great question. I actually have a lot of thoughts on this. I think one is to mirror that behavior myself. So to make it very clear that whenever I'm in a meeting, you know, and because of the position I'm in, often there's a gravity or assumptions about why I'm asking a question. So I think that takes time and trust in the leader to build up over time that, you know, I'm asking and making clear I'm curious about something. This is not a directive. I'm asking and making it very comfortable to just have a dialogue. Just it's not me as a CTO maybe asking. It's me just as a fellow data scientist or a fellow engineer trying to understand. And so I constantly try to create a little bit more levity and just mirror that behavior. I think second is, and this is more from the point of view of when I'm answering questions, is being honest and authentic in the answer. I think the biggest disincentive for asking questions is when you know that A, you're not going to get a good answer, or B, it's not really an honest or authentic answer. It's basically just talking points or something like that. And then, or C, there's nothing really that's going to follow up. I mean, some questions are more informational, but some questions are more action oriented. Like, what are we going to do about this? What are our plans here? And so if there's no follow-up, no action, right? Like people start to understand that there's not a point in asking. And so I try to be as authentic and honest and transparent in my answers as possible. And I think that comes across. I think people are really good at detecting whether there's, you know, honesty and transparency and authenticity and reliability in answers. And so I think, again, that comes back to the character of the leader. And so I think that comes back to being humble and not assuming I know certain things and being very honest when I say I don't know. I need to get back to that. Or if there are things I know but I can't share, again, not trying to be purposefully opaque, but being honest in that and saying, you know, there's certain things I can't share right now, or, you know, we're in a difficult situation. We'll work through it together. You know, we'll figure out some options and come back to this. Or and there's other situations where I think your job as a leader is to shield the team from some things, from information, from thrashing, for instance, that might be going on in terms of other kinds of priorities or other political or other situations that might be going on. And so trying to then, that's on me to navigate what to share and what not to share, because sometimes it's a burden to put on the team that they have something that might cause them concern or stress unduly until things are more clear on where things are going. And so I think that there's a couple books that I like. One is Managing Transitions, on kind of like how to communicate, where to communicate, that over communication is good and creating trust and authenticity. I think Team of Teams is good on just kind of having this big disorganized structure and allowing people to really open and communicate between each other. And I guess the last point I'll say here is I might not be the best person to answer the question, right? And so pointing to other people or allowing other people to answer the question, I think, isn't itself an act of mirroring that I'm not assuming I'm the authority on everything or that I need to be the one answering. I'm very happy to say to someone else, hey, I think you're better to answer this question. Or they might start answering and, you know, and they say, hey, do you have anything to add? And, you know, unless there's something that I really think was off, even if I would have something to add, maybe I don't, right? Like I make a decision to kind of leave that there and have them own whatever the answer is or whatever the decision is. Because, and again, I think a lot of people say this. I think Stan McChrystal, I know, says this, you know, a decision or an answer that someone made or owns, even if it's not 100% what I would have said, the execution and the follow through on that is going to be much better than if I'm coming down and dictating something. I think just understanding how much and where I should interject or ask a question or not. So that was a longer answer probably than you were expecting.
No, I like the details. I actually appreciate the thought process. And I think a lot of that makes sense and actually resonates with me. And I was actually thinking, as you mentioned, you know, your role in the company and tying it back to, you know, how the company was comfortable and trusted you to grow into the CTO role. And obviously it pushes you into those uncomfortable areas. Obviously, you know, there's questions to be asked and you have to ask yourself questions, obviously, of where those gaps are. And sometimes asking questions of ourselves is the trickiest thing because we can also rationalize our answers so easily. And I was partially thinking you probably could, you know, build a model to see what criteria of success you would have had given, you know, your background and other factors. But I guess when you were getting first into the role as a CTO, were there specific things that you were like, you know what, I know these are areas, you know, I've probed, I've asked questions. These are areas that I have gaps. I have a plan of how I'm going to manage the gaps, where I'm going to ramp up, where I'm going to decide I'm just not going to because I can't. Did you take that inventory and try to figure out how to balance that?
Absolutely. I think that inventory is, again, a great question, is something that there's a voice inside my head that's constantly questioning or criticizing things that I'm doing or saying. And so I constantly have this back and forth on assessing my own weaknesses and strengths. And I think that's, again, one of the qualities to your earlier question that I think that's really important in a leader. I think that's, you know, when you see leaders get out of touch or disconnected or kind of not be as authentic or humble anymore, I think that that voice, either externally someone saying that or internally, kind of starts to go off a little bit. And so, you know, as an individual contributor, I think you're concerned on making sure you're doing the right things. Like, you know, you have to keep up with the industry, figure out what's going on, whether, you know, I'll use data science as an example. That's what I'm familiar with. What research is coming out, you want to make sure you understand the right models, what's going on in conferences and journals and what other companies are doing. And so there's obviously, like, you know, your own personal strengths that you start to build up. As you grow as a manager and a director, I kind of think about it as a triple Venn diagram. So one part of the Venn diagram is the specific functional skills that I need as an engineer or data scientist and how important that is for my role. Second is understanding people management, leadership. And obviously that becomes much more important. And the third is the business itself, the actual mission, the vision of whatever the business is that you're doing. And as an individual contributor, you know, obviously you should be, I think, fairly large in that functional Venn diagram area. And then your people skills, your leadership skills, and your business skills don't have to be that large. Although I would argue actually that, you know, engineers that understand the business and understand how to work with people are much more effective overall. But, you know, that maybe I'll footnote that as a different part of the conversation. As I started to grow into managers, you know, director role, managing other people, I really had to be critical of myself of what am I missing in the people management and the business understanding, because my role starts to become such that my first team is oftentimes the other members of the senior leadership team or the executive team. And so understanding the business and why we need to make certain decisions that are not technically driven, but either business context, market context, geopolitical, other reasons are driven, and be able to translate that in a way that makes sense to my, you know, technology teams. And again, carry that mission and vision of why forward. So trying to learn, I look around at other leaders. I've been lucky enough where we've had a lot of leaders, both at FiscalNote as well as other people I see, you know, in the community that I work with, from various parts of the company, from sales to marketing to finance to HR, just learn from them, basically constantly be looking at what are they doing on their teams? How are they running their meetings? What are they doing in their one-on-ones? How are they structuring their offsites? What are they not doing that I'm doing? What am I doing, you know, that they're doing that I should be doing? Every day, to this day, I basically have those thoughts in my head when I look at a leader somewhere else. And so I'm constantly basically questioning and changing the process that I'm running, because things are breaking constantly as we grow, as any company grows, right? And so even if I thought I had it figured out at a certain point of the team size, it's not going to be the same in 3 months or 6 months or 12 months. So I've gotten very comfortable, and part of, I think, why I have been able to go from the 9-person company to now is I'm comfortable in this mix of chaos and order where I know what I think I can do well, and I have another foot kind of in the chaos of what is going to come next and looking forward. And that can manifest itself in a few ways. One, I'm looking at the team structure and asking myself, what is the right organization structure that we need now versus 3 months or 6 months from now? I think that's in the actual product vision. I think that's in how, you know, I should be growing as a leader. And on that last part, in that looking at that triple Venn diagram, I know there are places that I'm going to be weak. No matter how hard I try, there are people that are much better than that, just naturally. So, you know, I'll educate myself on organization and trying to be as good as I can be. But just personally for me, I think I'm stronger at vision and the strategy, but not actually the organization or execution of it, or kind of the tactical follow through steps of everything. I acknowledge that. And so what I look for in my team then is people who can weigh or balance out the places where I know I'm weak, even though I shore it up to the point that I feel comfortable enough, right, that it's not a complete weakness, that I'm not a burden to the team because of it. But at the same time, I think you have to assess whether it makes more sense for you to invest in your strengths and then figure out what the weaknesses are and have other people who can carry that or not. And I certainly think of that in the former, that it makes more sense to not try to be best at everything, but acknowledge where you're good and then figure out who and what are the right things that you need to support you. And so I think my team is composed of people who are better at me at almost everything that's specific to their role. So, you know, engineering wise, I have leaders that I think are much more knowledgeable about the particular engineering technologies that we're using today. I think operationally, I have people who are much more cognizant and available and capable of pushing forward on certain projects and things. And I'm 100% satisfied with knowing that they're better than me and actually promoting that idea and making sure that they know that and that they're critical to the organization and that, you know, they're the part of this team that kind of compounds everything together.
I like that. I was going to ask you, as you mentioned, you know, you have really strong leaders. I'm sure somebody is actually doing some of the data work that you used to do, even though, you know, it was part of what you built out. How tempting or how careful do you have to be to make sure you stay at the high level and not want to jump into the reins of your old baby? Because obviously you grew from a 9-person company to what you are now. You probably can jump into that machine and you want to be a builder, but obviously there's other people building, you know, you've got a different role. How do you fight that dilemma?
Yeah, no, to the huge chagrin of my team, I do still have code that's running in production and they're trying to rip it out as fast as possible, which I hope that they do. For sure. So I think again, that's something that is difficult to have a mindset shift around. I think it comes back to how do you derive your value to the company? What do you consider your impact? And so I think that I've seen a few different examples. I think I've seen on one hand, people who are clearly fantastic engineers and, you know, can grow into a principal architect kind of role and really have that vision and mindset of you know, steering a direction, but not necessarily managing people. And they want to become managers, right? And you know, you let them do that, and then they realize it's maybe not for them. On the other hand, you know, you have people who are managers and they'd clearly be better off, or vice versa, I guess, people who are not managing people. And just like you clearly see, like they should be managing and having people move in different directions. I think for myself, when I encountered the opportunity to become a manager, I thought that was something that I wanted to do. Like there was a skill set that I wanted to build. And I was comfortable with handing off the hat of not being in the code every day and deriving the impact I have for the company, not by the code I write or the models I build or the customers that I work with directly, but by knowing, understanding the problem, being able to translate that to the team and working through others to accomplish our mission. And I think that's, you know, become, there's challenges at each step. So when you're managing team directly, you can still know more or less exactly what's going on. You kind of have to keep track of everything. When you start managing managers and the managing directors and VPs, it becomes even more abstracted away. Like I would only be doing a disservice to someone if I jumped into a JIRA ticket today and started to ask questions about why we're doing certain a certain way. And so I think that over time, you get more and more comfortable, if you want to, with that transition of knowing your impact is derived through facilitating and leading through others, as opposed to doing it yourself. That's not for everyone. I think that comes back to being honest with yourself. I've had leaders who I think are very capable, people managers, technical leads, who have wanted and said, hey, I actually am not deriving the impact I think I could be. I actually would make bigger impact if I went back and led, like, either individually or maybe a much, much smaller team where, like, I still would be much more hands-on, like, player coach. And so I try to then facilitate that. Like, the whole goal for me then, like, the way I drive value is making sure that my team is as impactful as possible. And so if those individual members realize that they shouldn't be managing and their impact is actually, you know, directly, and it's not a judgment at all. It's not good or bad, right? It's, again, it's just coming back to being honest with yourself. You might think that your value is in one place when you realize it's not. Just quickly kind of adjust and come back to or go to an opportunity where you actually are fulfilled and impactful, because you're going to be much more happy and contribute more. And you know, the company you're working for is going to, I think, have a much more appreciative opinion of you if you're doing things that fulfill you. And so, you know, I could elaborate on that, but I think it comes back down to just knowing where you find value. And then that creates the mental shift to be comfortable handing things off. I think that when people are not ready to hand things off and they still feel like, I need to get in the code, I need to build this model, you know, there's something there where, you know, like, they're still attached to a certain persona of themselves, and they have to let it go. Because at some point, at some point I was still very much in the code. Like, I was part of sprints, even though I was leading these teams. And it got to the point where I was 100% doing a disservice to everyone involved by still having tickets assigned to me in a sprint that I knew that I would not get to, because I'd have 5 meetings pop up in the span of an afternoon that would be, you know, critical things I needed to go handle from the more managerial side. And I think it took me a little bit too long to realize I should step out of that. And then, you know, I think there's always that little lagging factor.
I love it. I appreciate, you know, everything you shared. I think this is a great insight into just the transition and also your thought process around, you know, again, building that team around you to kind of shore up what you thought were your strengths and weaknesses. I think it's been very interesting, and we'll have to have you come back to do a follow-up and talk a little bit more about some of the old hat you wore, because I'm sure there's a lot of things in that'd be great too. But I really appreciate the discussion with you. Before I let you go, I'd like to wrap up with a quick question here. It's a bit of a tradition on the show, but if you could ask the next guest to answer a question for you, another technology leader, what would you like for them to answer?
Yeah. So this is one that's been top of mind for me recently. I'm very curious on people's opinions of this. I think, you know, for the last couple years, at least, if not longer, there's really been a big push for getting as many people as possible educated on working with computers. And what I mean by that is programming, understanding languages, being able to, you know, develop software for themselves or for a company. With something coming out like, you know, like foundation models, GPT, and other things that are essentially intermediating a lot of some of those needs of people being as technically skilled as we thought, do we actually think that there's more value in having people understand how to program and build technology because there's this baseline that everyone's going to have and it's even more valuable to have the next level? Or is it actually less necessary where, you know, we were really pushing everyone, they had to understand computers, and now that there's a lot of stuff computers can do for you, we really don't need that many people who can program and build technology. Not an easy question, or just a, you know, obvious one, not leading, but it is, I think, very important for us to understand.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it's out there in the news, and I'm constantly wondering, you know, we see all the different roles out there, and software engineering in and of itself is, you know, obviously we're seeing that be built into some of these products, and it's gonna be, that's a good question. I'd love for somebody to come on. Hopefully I'll have the next guest who can maybe talk to that or has some expertise. I'd love to have somebody, because I think everyone would like to know a little bit of that direction. The other question is, obviously you talked a lot about your growth and leadership. If someone does want to reach out to you and connect and kind of, you know, ask you other questions or just kind of pick your brain about this, what is a good way of getting hold of you?
Sure. I think, you know, two ways. One, on LinkedIn. So Vlad Edelman, you know, I'll pop up at Fisconaut. And the second one is my email, vlad@fisconaut.com. Feel free to reach out on either of those.
Awesome. I appreciate the time, Vlad. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Amir. It's been a pleasure.